this month's edition of the Step Outside podcast. I'm Katie Donaldson, the communications specialist in the School of Natural Resources here at the University of Tennessee Institute of Agriculture. Today, joining me is Professor Adam Taylor, who has been on our podcast before. He is a wood products extension specialist for the University of Tennessee, and you recently returned from your stay in Finland for a Fulbright grant program. I'm just having you back on to talk about that. You were there from January until June.
Yeah, I was there from very short days of maybe about 4 hours to very long days in southern Finland, but still that's pretty far north. So you really noticed the change in day length.
And when you first went over there, or when I talked to you back in November, you talked about how you were going to look at carbon accounting and the impact on forests and forest products while you were there. But you also mentioned that you may have gone off track from that, depending on what you found, what they were researching there. So if you wouldn't mind just kind of talking a little bit about what your focus was there and any other aspects that kind of caught your attention while you were in Finland.
Yeah, well, with regard to what I proposed to do, I did want to leave myself a little wiggle room in case, you know, the specific plan of copying the methods in this particular paper didn't quite work out. And so, yeah, it did shift a little bit. But in fact, I ended up really studying the topic that I was interested in, which is, as you described, the relationship of carbon flows in and between forests and forest products. You know, in fact, my overall opinion about the matter, that wood is still a good thing as part of our climate mitigation efforts, hasn't changed. But I do have new knowledge of techniques and data that is used in that kind of argument. But yeah, so mostly kept on topic, even though some of the little details changed a little bit.
Did you come across anything that the Finns are doing differently from what we do here in the U.S.?
Yeah, there, and I sort of knew beforehand, but it got reinforced that they definitely consider the short-term impact on the forest when they're thinking about things like harvesting. And I come from a thought background in some of the work that I was doing where we were focused on products, where we assume that the carbon in the forest resource is unchanged over long time on average. And that's still, you know, a perfectly valid assumption, but it's not one that you have to use. And it's not one that many of the folks in Finland, they're looking at more short-term dynamics. So after you cut a forest, there's less trees there, there's less carbon, therefore, and that takes a while to bounce back. And if you're, you know, thinking about shorter-term timescales, and in fact, what that timescale can be varies a lot by the environment, because, for example, our forests grow a lot faster than their forests do. So it's a matter of perspective, both in terms of time, but also from the environment that you're working in. So they look at sort of short-term forest carbon dynamics much more. And then there's a lot of differences just in, I already mentioned, their forest ecosystems are quite different, and that affects how you think about things. The type of products that they get, that's different. And then finally, they have much more intensive forest management there in general than we do here in Tennessee. It's more similar to what they do down in the deep south with pine plantations. So there's a lot of differences. And that was kind of the point, was to try and look at how their different perspectives could be applied and modified here in the U.S.
Did you see any applications that you think would benefit applying to the U.S. or even just in our region?
Yeah. And, you know, it's not really a matter of changing practices on the ground, or at least not yet. It's more a matter of how we think about what's the best way to use a forest. And I became familiar with some of the arguments that are made. And so I want to sort of accommodate those arguments and maybe adapt them to the local situation. But it isn't a matter of they use a particular kind of tree and now we're going to use that kind of tree too. It's more just a matter of how you think about things at this point, which will possibly evolve into policies about how we manager for us. And that's really what got me started on it is, you know, we have a growing interest in a carbon market here in the US. So that includes at the moment things like landowners voluntarily in exchange for payment, changing their forest harvest practices. And I still have an interest in trying to make sure that the full benefits of the wood products that we get and the carbon aspects of the wood products that we get are fully accounted for in any such system. It doesn't mean that you couldn't reduce or delay your harvest in a forest, but I just want the system, if we can develop it, to fully reward landowners for the carbon benefits of the wood products that they produce in addition to the trees that they grow.
What you're saying is kind of is very similar to what we talked about last time about how some of those benefits from the carbon credit program, they're for landowners who kind of keep their trees instead of cutting them down. And I know you were saying there are benefits to cutting those trees down instead of just leaving them in the forest. Is that kind of a similar view to what the Finns have as well?
You know, not maybe directly in the way that I would like. See, my interest is trying to have these carbon programs that are related to forests fully recognize the carbon benefits of wood products. And there are two benefits. There is the benefit of the carbon that's actually stored in the wood. And to some limited extent, that's recognized in some of the carbon programs. But what isn't recognized at all is any substitution benefits, so-called, where you're using wood in place of a material that its production and use is associated with a lot of fossil carbon emissions. So if you use a wooden piece of wood in your, a wooden building material in your house, that means you're not using a piece of steel, which its manufacture would require the burning of a lot of coal or natural gas or something, and because it's an energy intensive product. So that isn't recognized. It's not recognized in Finland. It's not recognized here. But in Finland, they do have holistic, you know, sort of on a general level, a much greater appreciation of the overall benefits of wood. Not everybody, you know, there's a variety of opinions, of course. But for example, they use a lot of wood energy for heating and heating their communities and including their hot water. They've got this district heating system that works great. And the city of Helsinki, their largest city by far, has recently converted from using coal to heat their buildings and hot water to using wood biomass. And that all comes from that local renewable natural resource of the forest, which they get lots of other benefits from. So they're using sort of wood residues in that. And there's that huge carbon implications there in that they're not burning coal anymore. But that isn't part of some sort of, at the moment anyway, any carbon program for which the landowners are being paid for the carbon benefit. Of course, they get paid for the materials that are removed. So it gets a little complicated. But they, I would say, just there's a general awareness in Finland overall of the many benefits that forests provide. Whereas in the United States, I think many people are sort of not quite fully aware of all the things that forests do for us, in addition to being a forest and providing things like a beautiful view and clean air and clean water. And stuff. Just that the general feeling is different. The policies actually are a little bit similar, but the attitudes may be a little different.
Do you think the awareness is getting better in the US, or do you think that's going to be a challenge moving forward?
Oh, I guess I think that I think they're maybe getting better overall. I think there's growing opportunity to have a full appreciation of the benefits of forests. That doesn't mean it'll automatically happen. But yeah, I think it's sort of instinctive for people to feel good about not cutting trees, because there's this instinct that if you cut the tree, then you've sort of lost something. And, you know, it depends. You have lost that tree, and its carbon is now in a different form. You know, if it's left in the forest, it will decompose and release carbon dioxide again. Or if you're going to lose some in the processing to gas again, and you also open up the forest floor to more sunlight, so there'll be more decomposition in the cool, shady spot that was maintained by that tree. On the other hand, you know, as a person who's been thinking about this for a while, I've always enjoyed the fact that using a tree doesn't mean you don't have the forest anymore. And that forest can continue to produce trees in the future. And that's, it's a renewable natural resource. And that's, you know, it comes off the tongue so quickly that we kind of take it for granted, but that's profound, you know, the fact that we can use our forests and continue to have them. And that doesn't mean that deforestation or land conversion doesn't occur globally and in the United States to some extent, but the potential is there to have a renewable natural resource, which provides carbon sequestration and carbon substitution, you know, indefinitely, sustainably, if we manage it right.
Is there anything about the research that you did while there that you were not expecting or that kind of surprised you?
No, maybe not. Certain things, I was reinforced in my understanding of it. And, you know, because I dove pretty deep into these, what's called, it's getting a little technical, but the so-called substitution factor. And this is, if we think about, I was using the example of a wooden piece of lumber taking the place of a steel stud in a wall in a house, for example. And if you're trying to calculate, well, how much fossil energy would have gone into that steel stud versus compared to how much fossil energy would have gone into making that wooden stud. And it's a lot more for the steel stud, but when you figure out how much more and do the calculation per unit of some sort, that's the calculation of the substitution factor. And that's actually a really difficult thing to do, calculate that number. I think conceptually it's really easy to understand. And for a product like a 2x4 that goes in a wall, it's pretty straightforward because you'd use one of those instead of one of those. But you get into what's the equivalent of a hardwood floor. Is it a linoleum floor with something underneath it, or is that a little different? And it gets more complicated from there. You know, if you think about what's an email worth versus a letter written on a piece of paper, it gets pretty impossible to talk about the equivalency of things. And even then, you still need, even if you decide this is the same function as that, you have to try and dig into the data of how much energy goes into these various products, how long those various products last. Does a wooden floor last longer than a linoleum floor? Well, we think so, but it's really hard to get data on that. So trying to quantify this concept of the substitution factor is extremely difficult. It's extremely uncertain. And some people get so frustrated with the difficulty and the uncertainty that they want to just give it up altogether, including me at times. But, you know, maybe if we could just go with the concept that it's important. But if we're going to try and pay per unit of carbon dioxide, then we do need to somehow put a number on it. So I guess it wasn't a surprise so much as just an unpleasant confirmation of how difficult it is.
Do you think over time, as this research continues, it will eventually get easier to quantify that number?
Yes, but only because we have agreed on some assumptions, and that's pretty important. There is no recognized standard way of doing it. And if we ever do develop a standard way of doing it, that's going to mean that somebody's won and somebody's lost in terms of how we're going to do these assumptions, because it matters what you assume. And your perspective, of course, is going to probably influence the assumptions that you want to make. So, unfortunately, we really do have value judgments that are inescapable, and they permeate this, what we would like to have be a science. But, you know, we always have to understand that a scientist's opinions are going to affect their perspective on the science. And this is an example of where we have to try and identify what's the assumptions and the bias that's inherent there, and what's the numbers. So we may get to a point where we start having some standardization, but we're also going to lose something there too, in terms of what, you know, potential assumptions are implying to the whole system.
Speaking of just different opinions and coming from different scientists, being in Finland, what was it like just being in that culture, being immersed there, experiencing the Finnish culture?
Yeah, I was just asked this question recently about how different was the university over there. And so the university includes, you know, academics and students and things like that. And actually that aspect of it, I would say, felt a little familiar. The whole in culture and environment of Finland is very different. And of course, that permeates because those people are Finnish and we're living in Finland at the time. But a lot of the, you know, you have a variety of opinions and I don't know, it seemed actually kind of familiar. There wasn't really a Finnish way of being an academic that I noticed. Finnish people are kind and polite and quiet. They have a reputation for being reserved, which I think, you know, so for example, what I always say is, if you go into the grocery store here, it's very likely you'll have a conversation with the cashier or something, you know, like that's just not unusual. In Finland, they don't do that, not generally. It's just more sort of quiet and reserved. But once you get used to that, it's perfectly fine.
Was there anything while you're visiting that country that you experienced that outside of, I guess, the academic realm that you're really glad you had that experience or something that you think is just, you mentioned that your family went with you, something that's probably going to be something that sits with them for the rest of their lives, anything like that?
Yeah, of course, there's a lot of things. It was just an amazing experience. And I would encourage anybody who's ever has the opportunity to live somewhere else. You know, this wasn't a visit. I mean, of course, it was a visit. We were never finished. We didn't speak the language. But 6 months is long enough that you kind of have a routine. And it's just, you're not sightseeing so much anymore. It's kind of just going through the motions of a daily life. And it's just fantastic experience with 1,000 facets to the gem of that experience. But the one that really comes to mind, which I feel like sharing with people is, and there's even technical, you can get technical about it because the economists measure these things, but it's a less unequal society. The rich aren't as much richer than the poor are as the case here. And I think I could be wrong. There could be other explanations, but what goes through my mind is that that is responsible for a sense of peace and security in daily life that was very strong, very noticeable. It's as if people aren't in danger of slipping through the cracks and having some life-threatening catastrophe, like maybe getting sick and not being able to pay for it or something. Of course, you know, so for example, they have socialized medicine there. But more than just the healthcare system, it just seems like anybody who's got a job is, they're going to be okay. And that gives a sense of security. And I'll give you an example for my family. So my wife and my daughter felt no qualms at all about walking along the street at night alone. And that's a feeling that for them was very different than being in the United States. And I'm not trying to accuse the United States of anything or, you know, complain about life here because it's fantastic to be home and I love this country that I live in. But I'm telling you that was the perspective of two people that I know. And, you know, they're women and they have their own perspective on personal safety. I don't worry necessarily about walking down the street here at night, but I know a lot of people do. And that feeling was absent in Finland. And I think it had something to do with just the general sense of security that people have. And, you know, kind of as a follow-up, everyone's heard that the Finns are the happiest people on earth in terms of the rankings. And it's been that way for a number of years. Well, that's what I think is happy, is that they feel secure and content in their daily lives with what they have. They're not fabulously wealthy and they're not fabulously happy in the sense that I would have defined it of walking down the street smiling and laughing. That's not them. They are walking down the street with a pretty quiet look on their face and maybe even look like they're not in a great mood. But they just, I guess my impression was that there's a sense of security and peace in the country that makes them, by the measure that's done, happy.
Definitely a different, like you said, different perspective, different culture that they seem to have than here in the U.S. Is there anything else that you would like to add that I have not asked you?
Only that it's, you know, it. Of course, I had a great time in Finland. I had a great time being out of my everyday life. So those are two different things that occurred in the same spot. That said, it's great to be back too, you know, and for a couple of reasons. I love where I work. And I also love my home life here. You know, it's my home. So it was great to be gone, but I'm not pouting or anything that I'm back. I'm happy to be back.
And is there anything, I guess, that's unique to either the US or Tennessee that you are very happy to have back in your life?
A small thing, but you know, you step off the airplane in Knoxville and it's like, whoop, you're in the jungle again. It's humid. Everything's super green. I mean, Finland is a green country. It's almost, you know, entirely forest and lakes, but there's a certain kind of level of chlorophyll intensity that's happening down here in the humid, sunny South that is really, it's kind of cool. I like it.
Well, good. Well, we're glad you're back and glad you get to enjoy, like you said, the chlorophyll filled region that the Southeast is.
A special place. Thanks for the opportunity to let me talk about my experience in Finland and my happiness to be back.
Well, thank you again.